It's Air Talk on KPCC. Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle. Well, following fashion is sometimes dismissed as trivial by serious intellectuals, or journalism types for that matter. Paying attention to outfits or hairstyles is considered a shallow, commercialized pursuit in some corners. But what people wear and what informal and formal dress codes allow them to wear has a deep connection to power dynamics in society, and it's an important lens to look through to understand culture and political movements. In his new book, my next guest examined the history and symbolism of fashion in areas such as race, business, religion, and gender. Richard Thompson Ford is with me. He's the author of Dress Codes: How the Laws of Fashion Made History. And it's out this month. He's a professor of law at Stanford University. Oh, by the way, you also teach law on the side while you are writing a really fascinating books. Thank you, Richard Thompson Ford, for being here on Air Talk.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on the show.
So I can't tell you how refreshing, first of all, it was to read about top hats and cummerbunds while I was sitting around my pandemic, apartment, wearing sweatpants, eating snacks, brushing it off my sweatshirt. So thank you so much for that, first of all. And you start your book with a quote from Miuccia Prada, the head designer for Prada and Miu Miu. And she says, "Fashion is instant language." And I want to hear from you why you chose to start your book that way and what that means to you. Fashion is instant language.
Well, fashion conveys so much, and it's something that we carry around on our bodies, and people see it. It has a visceral effect. And I thought that quote, instant language, is perfect because it tells so much about what a person aspires to be, where they fit in society, and about the society in which they live just right away.
You use the term self-fashioning, really clothing as communication to the outside world, but also internally to oneself. Is that what you're going for there?
Yes, exactly. That fashion is a way of shaping how you will enter society. And the way you think about yourself, that's a lot of the history that I wrote about in the book, involved people who were constructing a sense of self in part by what they wore, along with things like narratives about their family or narratives, biography, portraits. Fashion was one of the ways that people transformed the way they thought about themselves as individuals.
You talk about the law. You're a professor of law at Stanford. Yes. It makes sense. And the way that dress codes are really regulated throughout history, sometimes just by cultural rules, kind of unwritten rules, but oftentimes actually by codified laws. What are some of the examples in the historical record of, you know, why governments, institutions, and societies cared about what people wore?
Yes, well, the book, I stretch back to the late Middle Ages. And during, for instance, in Tudor England, there were lots of laws, just a series of what they called acts of apparel, that regulated what people could wear according to their social position in society. And so, you know, these were societies where power was conveyed in large part through spectacle. There were grand spectacles. If you look at portraits of Henry VIII or Queen Elizabeth, the clothing had a great deal to do with how they exercised power and established their position.
Not subtle, so, those outfits.
No, not. Absolutely. That's right. Not subtle at all. You know, I am the queen and here I am in my magnificence. So it was really important that other people who weren't in those social positions didn't try to use the same types of fashion themselves, because that would kind of undermine or water down the message. And that's why they passed, a big part of the reason why they passed these series of laws. And there were a lot of them all over Western Europe. And they were consistently being updated kind of to keep up with new fashions as people from all walks of life it started to adopt these new fashions.
You talk later on, this shift from, first of all, opulence in fashion to more of an understated elegance during the Enlightenment as we move into the late 18th century. But later on, especially, throughout the history of America, you describe this evolution of the way that Black communities were policed in what they wore, and also how the dress and choice of outfits paralleled the civil rights movement. Can you talk about the history of that in America?
Oh, absolutely. So in the United States, we had, for instance, in 1740, there was a law called the Negro Act that prohibited in the language, Negroes and slaves from dressing above their condition. So there was a concern to maintain racial hierarchy by maintaining this sort of sartorial hierarchy in which you could tell someone's status by what they wore. So that has a long history, but also that would line up with the racial hierarchy and rather than confuse it. And so early on, African-Americans were using fashion both to express themselves and their own personality, but also to challenge racial hierarchy. And this continued such that, after emancipation, racist mobs would regularly attack Black people who were too well-dressed in their view, or who wore their Sunday best on, at a time other than going to church. And this relationship between race and fashion continued into the civil rights movement. So when you think about in the 1960s, the March on Washington, where civil rights protesters wore their Sunday best. They wore their Sunday best to sit in at lunch counters. And this wasn't just a way to ingratiate themselves to the white power structure. It was actually a challenge to white supremacy to see Black people dressed in this dignified fashion. Now, it changed over time, and new generations of civil rights activists found new ways to use fashion. But if you look at the way people, the Black Panthers, for instance, dressed, they were quite deliberate about this. This wasn't just what they decided to toss on. The Black Panthers had a minister of culture, and the minister of culture thought a lot about the relationship between fashion and grooming and racial pride. And so it was an important part of their civil rights struggle. And you could see it really clearly in how consistent their attire was.
And you write now today, African-Americans struggle, I'm quoting you here, African-Americans struggle over what some see as the elitism of respectability politics and what others condemn as the impracticality and subtler elitism of radical chic. Can you explore that briefly with me? I think that's such an interesting element playing out in, protests that we see today over civil rights.
Yeah. So, I mean, in today's environment, there's an idea that respectability politics is, something to be condemned, that it's like a snobbery on the part of certain African-Americans that expect others to be respectable.
And or so it's a capitulation also to power structures, right?
Exactly. Yes, exactly. It's a capitulation to power structures. So it's kind of cowardly and snobbish at the same time. And people would describe some of the Sunday best attire in the early civil rights movement as kind of participating in this politics of respectability. So there's that tension. And you definitely saw that in later generations of civil rights activists. SNCC, for example, rejected Sunday best. And so we've got that as a set of ideas. But at the same time, people reacted to the kind of dressed down look of later generations of civil rights activists. Some people said, that's kind of self-indulgent. It's a little bit, one person even said, hey, I came from a background where people were poor and we dressed as well as we could. And so she found, this use of dressed down stuff to be kind of impractical and maybe even a little bit insulting to the poor. And I think we still have that kind of tension today about what's appropriate and what's the most empowering way to think about clothing and self-presentation.
You mentioned earlier racist mobs who attacked Black people in America's history because of being too well-dressed, the people being, sticking out because they were well-dressed. In chapter 11 of your book, and let me just reset here because it's a really great read. It's called Dress Codes, How the Laws of Fashion Made History. And it's by Richard Thompson Ford, my guest right now on Air Talk. In chapter 11, you talk about the Zoot Suit Riots, which is, you know, close in our history here in Los Angeles. This occurred in 1943 in East L.A. It was mostly sailors that were on leave, mostly white people roaming around and beating up Chicano men in East L.A. because they had these distinctive suits, Zoot Suits, kind of baggy legs and bright colors. These mobs even burned the suits, cut these young Chicano men's hair. Talk to me about the politics of all of this. Was it just straight up racism? And how did the suit itself symbolize something larger?
Yes. So, I mean, certainly racism played a significant role, but these Zoot Suits became a symbol of kind of social alienation. And it's an interesting example because there was a politics to the wearing the Zoot Suit, but it wasn't explicit. It wasn't as if the Zoot Suiters were part of a, you know, a civil rights struggle per se, but wearing this kind of exaggerated suit. So the business suit had become, you know, really a symbol of bourgeois respectability and civic virtue of a particular kind. And the Zoot Suit was kind of mocking that. You know, I mean, it was big, it was flamboyant, it, you know, it was sexy. It was all the things the suit weren't, what wasn't, the normal suit wasn't. And people really saw that as a threat and as a provocation. And so when these soldiers came home on leave, they went and tried to track down these young men who and burnt their suits and there were Zoot Suit riots all over the United States, not just in Los Angeles, although the one in LA was the largest, but all over the country, the Zoot Suit was seen as this kind of symbol of youthful alienation and sort of disrespect for the mainstream.
I learned from your book that Malcolm X even wore a Zoot Suit before he converted to Islam. That the spread of the suit, I did not realize it, its reach across the country. It's just such a fascinating book. And one last set of issues I'd love to cover with you today is gender, because of course fashion is often used to police gender, to signify gender, to keep, you know, women especially in their place. Can you discuss why it is over the years that we have so many elements of women's fashion, even up till today when we think of ourselves as very woke when it comes to gender politics, elements of women's fashion that are associated with pain? I mean, you know, corsets, high heels, skinny jeans, push-up bras, artificial makeup and hair. It's all fun. I mean, I am somebody who keeps up with trends and I consume these things, but they are often expensive and sometimes even painful. I mean, why is it that this has, you know, followed us even till today, especially women's garb and discomfort?
Yes. So for so long, I mean, throughout the history that I write about that starts in the late Middle Ages, the rules around women's attire have been quite fraught, and women have been caught in this kind of continual catch-22 between, on the one hand, needing to be decorative, and the other hand, needing to be modest. And this tension between the two creates a situation where the, you know, women can't win. It's a tightrope that they need to walk. Now, all the things that you're describing, you know, they're modifications, or kind of almost a discipline of the female body. And that's been a consistent theme with women's dress as well. The woman until the early 20th century always had to be draped from the waist down. Men wore pants, women wore draped garments, as if the lower half of the female body wasn't fit for, you know, public consumption. And we still have this kind of relationship to women's bodies today.
I'm so happy that I got a chance to talk to you about this book. Richard Thompson Ford, author of Dress Codes, How the Laws of Fashion Made History. And it's out this month from Simon & Schuster. He's a professor of law at Stanford University. Thank you so much, Professor Ford, for being with us on Air Talk.
Thank you so much.
I'm Libby Denkman, sitting in for Larry Mantle just for today. Thank you so much for listening. Fresh Air is up next.